feel like I have a pretty good handle on where he's going at the beginning of chapter 30.
Okay.
Some things are a little easier to understand what he's saying.
Yep, yep.
That was pretty straightforward.
Starts naming names, huh? Okay.
And not a different name that you're...
Right, right. Okay. Well, man, it seems like I woke up this week and behold, summer was here. With all of its life and demands and all of that, it just seems like things really accelerate in the summer. But we have more hours in the day to work, so that's good. We'll take care of those things. But here we are. Isaiah chapter 30. And as Matt says, he's pretty clear here about his focus. And this is woe number 4 of the 6 we've been looking at. Woe to the rebellious children, saith the Lord, that take counsel, but not of me, that cover with a covering, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin. So it's not that the children were self-sufficient and that they knew what they needed and where they were going. They were looking for advice, looking for counsel, but they weren't interested in God's counsel. Woe to them. The covering expression there sort of suggests a little different than the Hebrew. This is a word we've seen before, which sort of illuminated to us the connection in the language of Hebrew, as well as in the mind of the prophets, the connection between idolatry and living under a veil, this lack of clarity, this lack of vision of what is real, this deception of idolatry. So rather than the Spirit of God, it is an offering, as it were, to the idols, in this case, of Egypt, that walk to go down into Egypt and have not asked at my mouth to strengthen themselves in the strength of Pharaoh and to trust in the shadow of Egypt. And as we've noted, Isaiah is really, this is one of his most frustrating experiences in his lifetime, I think, this return to Egypt of the leadership of the Israelites. And he's totally indignant about it. He's like, Egypt, right? With an attitude. This is where we came out of, right? This is where we experienced years and years of slavery, oppression, where they murdered our male babies. This is what God has rescued us from. And you are rejecting his counsel to go to Egypt. Really now?
Free housing and healthcare in Egypt.
Yes, they did have that.
Free?
You're slaves. You don't have to worry about that. Somebody else.
The picture of trust here. What are you trusting in? He can't even. He has to diss them even in the expression of their strength. The shadow. It's this. You're trusting in their shadow. What are you going to get out of that? Therefore, shall the strength of Pharaoh be your shame, and the trust in the shadow of Egypt, your confusion. And of course, I remind you that the history here that sets the context for this discussion is the imminent advance of the Assyrian army into the Levant, this part of the world, and the attempt to build a coalition of nations against them, of which Egypt was one of the prime instigators, and Israel was seeking to find sufficient partners in their facing off with the advance of the Assyrians by allying themselves with Egypt. Isaiah says, "For his princes were at Zoan, and his ambassadors came to Hanes." So these are towns in Egypt during this period where he seems to be reflecting on ambassadors from Jerusalem going there to do alliance talks with the Egyptians. And he says they were all ashamed of a people that could not profit them, nor be a help nor profit, but a shame and also a reproach. And then he has a section here which has an element of satire to it. Verse 6 says, the burden of the beasts of the south. Okay, so when I first read that, I thought of, okay, these are beasts of burden. But throughout Isaiah, we see this word burden in the King James, and what is he referring to when he talks about the burden of this or the burden of that? It's an oracle, right? So this is the prophecy about the beasts of the south. And so he proceeds then to talk about the animals that would have taken the gifts for the ambassadors south to the Egyptians. So in his mind, they were more important than the actual mission that was going on here. So the oracle there's a funny translation of this in one of the others, Beasts of Burden. The Septuagint, the vision of the quadrupeds in the desert. Yep, already. I like that one. Into the land of trouble and anguish, from whence come the young and old lion, the viper, and fiery flying serpent. It's a great place to live. They will carry their riches upon the shoulders of young donkeys, and their treasures upon the bunches of camels, to a people that shall not profit them. Okay, so the story about the quadrupeds. That's the thing that he thinks the biggest deal is here. Look at the plight they're in. For the Egyptians shall help in vain and to no purpose. Okay, so this is another notable expression that sort of is lackluster in this translation. The Complete Jewish Bible says, "For Egypt's help is worthless, pointless." And I didn't actually finish the verse, and they do all the seven in King James. "For the Egyptians shall help in vain and to no purpose. Therefore have I cried concerning this. Their strength is to sit still." Okay, how's that for a compliment for a military force? They do great sitting still. That doesn't sound very conquering, does it? Yes.
Verse in the ESV,
Yes.
Therefore, I have called her Rahab, who sits still.
So, Rahab is pronounced the same way as the lady whose name was Rahab in Jericho, but it's a slightly different spelling in Hebrew. So, if we look at that in terms of its usage, this is a word which sometimes is used to refer to Egypt in a derogatory sense. It's translated strength here in verse 7, but we see that in other places it is used as translated as proud. Sometimes refers to a mythical sea monster, a storm, or arrogance. So it's a term which is used here, not as a compliment. So, like in the Complete Jewish Bible, it's translated, "For Egypt's help is worthless, pointless. So I call her arrogance, doing nothing." Arrogance, doing nothing. So that's kind of like sitting still, right? And then apparently, because of the structure of that verse, the force of it is exclamatory. So Egypt, futile and empty is their help. So there's attitude here that you don't see in just reading the King James of verse 7. Isaiah is totally incredulous that this is happening. Okay, does that satisfy your curiosity there, Matt, as far as Rahab? Yeah, okay. Actually not connected at all to the name Rahab as a person's name, which even has a different meaning.
Was it capitalized in the ESV?
Yes.
So it's used as a name, but not the lady's name. So
it's not like she's like that.
Right. So let me. I did compare it and look up her name this morning, but I did some other things after that, so I don't remember what I found. You ever have that problem? Let's see here. So the name of the lady means wide. perhaps not a compliment either, but perhaps because there was a time whenever that was a sign of prosperity. So different Hebrew spelling. Okay. There's certainly some things which, if all you have is a version of the Bible, one, you're sort of in the dark about what's going on. And I found that in a book like Isaiah, it takes a lot of looking to begin to get into the heart of the communication here. So he is incredulous that they would go to Egypt for help and reject the counsel of the Lord. He says, "Now go, write it before them in a table, note it in a book." And so this is like saying, "Do it publicly and also privately." The table would be for public, a tablet on a plank or a stone would be for public consumption, and the book would be more personal. That it may be for the time to come, forever and ever. That this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of the Lord, which say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things. Speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. Get you out of the way, turn aside out of the path. Cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us. Okay, so what Isaiah here is saying is not what was actually being said in words. Those are not things that you say. You don't tell people, you don't tell the preacher, lie to us today, right? In those words. But you might say, you know, could you be a little more diplomatic? Could you go easy on certain topics? Could you shade things in a more palatable form? Well, Isaiah says, you might as well be saying, don't see, don't speak what's right. And the reason for all that is that the source of truth in his mind is what he calls the Holy One of Israel. Now, can you think of why it is that that expression, the Holy One of Israel, would imply something about the nature of God that makes him unpalatable to man? How does that communicate something about God that causes us concern? Okay, so the term holy speaks of his separation. Why is that disconcerting?
Also speaks of moral purity, so sinful man doesn't want God to be pure because sinful man doesn't want to be pure.
Okay. I think those are all good points. What about this? As human beings, we often find ourselves in tight spots, in situations, in relationship-driven necessity, shall we say. Think about that for a minute. What controls the flow of our society? When you think about the direction that things go, in whether it's local government, or at a level of the issues that are discussed in schools, or the policies that are enacted. What is the guiding force in all that? You know, we've recently been through an episode here in Salem with the city council and planning zoning commission, whatnot. What controlled the flow of policy in that particular episode, would you say?
The desire of the ones with the most authority?
Okay, certainly if they're in a position of authority, they can make decisions, but what controlled... What was the force? I talked to a neighbor to that project out there, and of course most of the neighbors weren't very happy at all about that. I'm talking about the marijuana growing facility. And, but he was like, well, that's kind of how things were going. He's like, giving up without a fight. It's just, that's how things are going. And so when you think about, okay, what is the force in society? It's kind of an unseen thing, but it's something we all feel. It's like, it's the force of the flesh at a given point in time. The different things that have come together to change people's minds in little incremental ways. Well, compare that to holiness. Okay. God is totally separate from all that. His truth totally disregards the trends and the fashions and the changing attitudes of people. Well, that makes us quite uncomfortable, right? It's like, look, God, you know, we got an issue here. I've got relationships with these people, and I need to be able to respond to what they're saying and what they're doing, what they care about. But holiness doesn't. The truth doesn't change with how the fads are going, what the prevailing moral sensibility is. It is consistent. What's just is always just. What's true is always true. What's wrong continues to be wrong. And so when you understand our intrinsic response to holiness, it's like, whoa, you know, that's uncomfortable. We need to accommodate. We need to adjust. We need to react to what's going on right now.
Isn't it true that by nature, if it doesn't immediately affect my security, my, you know, whether that's income or my ability to eat and work and motivate, and, you know, if I'm comfortable, by nature, I'm less apt to think outside of that comfort. I mean, and make a statement or make a move to try to stop something that's not necessarily an immediate threat. I wonder if, you know, we're so spoiled, and for so long we've had it so easy and so good that we can hardly believe how this is going to end up.
Okay, so you're thinking more of personal applications of how I should live. I was just trying to illustrate how the holiness of God causes us discomfort whenever we are not trying to follow His holiness, but just moving along, not doing anything wrong, per se. You know, that whole question of, well, is there anything wrong with this, is really a very short-sighted way to view the world. And it does not keep you in touch with the holiness of God to just ask, well, is there anything wrong with it? The question that you ask is, well, where is God in this? Where does He stand? What would be a position which reflects a reliance totally on His input? When you think about the people that form the direction that people's lives go in our world, they're not in any way listening to the voice of God in their life. They don't care. They reject it. Well, if those are the voices that are forming your opinions of what is acceptable and what is right, you're not responding to a holy God. And so Isaiah here is just pointing out this tendency, and the Israelites were not inhuman in this. They were a part of their world. They had become a part of their society and of the international society. Okay, they're thinking in terms of their relationship with the superpowers here. And in so doing, they're like, okay, you know, the prophets need to back off here. Speak into us, smooth things. To some extent, we're happy to have a national God, and we'll worship Yahweh, as the book says we're supposed to, more or less. But take it easy on some stuff.
Being winsome with a Christianity is not the goal. And it kind of threw me for a loop a little bit because, you know, I've struggled with what to think about that, because definitely most of the flow of the culture resists any kind of direct instruction from religious people or admonishment or whatever. And I don't know exactly even how to think about that, but I mean, that certainly, speaking to us smooth things made me think of it.
Winsome would not be the end goal. Winsome would just be how one aspect of achieving ultimate goals, but ultimately spreading what is true and good and just and right. Holy is would be closer to, if not the goal. Winsome is just one part of it, not in and of itself. Okay? It just may help in many circumstances achieve the bigger goal.
I think I've learned that you certainly can't be effective in convincing anybody if you're not. At least most people, they just won't even listen if you are not really careful about how you come across. But I don't know how that works into this.
Well, there's a place for each. Paul didn't always say, "Oh foolish Galatians, oh foolish Corinthians, oh foolish," all the time and just run them down. But he did say it. I would not have you ignorant. But then he also found ways to praise them and encourage them. So, you know, I was thinking of the phrase that some of the old-time preachers had. They saw their goal, or one goal was to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comforted. You know, because you got to, sometimes things need to be stirred up. But if you just stir things up, you're not accomplishing the goal either.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's some issues that are non-negotiable. And what's so easy to happen is if you're focused totally on relationship and winsomeness, you get into the position where you are a victim of the truth in your life becomes a victim of relationship. And so, you know, we've gone in this country from the point where at one time, the Bible was considered the basis for justice, for morality, for truth, to the point where now it is a scathing indictment of the justices of our world, of our country, to be religious, to be Bible-believing. That's like the ultimate degradatory thing you can say. It's just out of hand, shows how bad, how immoral they are, that they would believe what the Bible says for morality. Well, the non-negotiable, what is it there? That God has spoken. God has spoken in time. And he is the ultimate holy voice on what is true and what is good. And if that's not a non-negotiable, then where your world goes, where your civilization goes, is totally at the whims of the prevailing forces in your world. Whether it's Hollywood or George Soros or whoever that has accumulated enough power and influence to control culture. And they felt that as a justifying response to any criticism. We didn't do this for moral reasons. And it's like, oh, okay, well, you did the right thing then.
Keith, there's a situation that I've encountered a couple times that comes to mind. And it took me a while before I figured out what was going on, but I had a conversation with a guy that said, well, you know, if a young lady gets assaulted and ends up pregnant, I couldn't tell her that she's got to keep the baby. And I just, you know, I'm not quick on my feet, so I don't think of the right thing. And it actually...
Join a club.
It happened later on again, you know, months, years later, the conversation came up again, and I still wasn't, well, in thinking about it, and then you apply what you learned to what you've encountered, and so the third time it happened, it's like, but it's not your decision. See, this has already been decided. God decided what should happen. So you don't have to tell her, I think you need to do this. Mm-hmm. Because it's not, you know, you're putting yourself in God's place.
Mm-hmm.
It was, the argument was so I got pulled in and didn't realize the bigger picture that that there is, it's not up to us to decide whether this is right or wrong or whether somebody should do that. It's been decided.
I suppose that's part of the self-deception of democracy, right? The idea that I have a voice, and therefore I couldn't say that, and therefore I won't. But there are issues that, as Matt very well said, are not our decision. It's not for me to say. And that's not how I come to a position of where I should stand. You know?
And not just something that strong, but there are other issues too that you hear, you know, people in the church say, well, you know, my child is struggling with this or struggling with that, and they don't want to, and you don't need to be harsh about it, but at the same time, it gives people, especially a child, a sense of security to know, well, these are boundaries, and I didn't just, you know, throw a dart at the wall and, oh, okay, here's where the boundary's going to be. But these are boundaries, and they're for a reason, and I just am trying to follow God. It gives the child then a sense of security to know there is order to the universe, and mom and dad are on board with that.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, oh, that's harsh, and they're just... It actually... Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they won't react initially, but at some point in their life, they will also see that mm-hmm. is a good thing.
Well, there have been so many ways that man has tried to dilute the strength of that kind of perspective. For instance, we'll talk about, well, so-and-so believes that this is true. So-and-so believes that abortion would be murder.
Right.
But I don't believe that. So it just becomes a matter of belief, right? So it is important that we do carefully examine our positions to make sure they do reflect God's position on issues, because it is truly an issue to consider of whether or not I have stated it properly. But to make all moral judgment a matter of personal belief then robs God of his authority.
We're no different from the Jews, that the rabbis that say, well, God's given it to us now to decide, and we're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
I also would observe different reactions as people got up and spoke. You hear them here, there, and yonder talking about that whole, the marijuana grow facility. And back to Laura's point about being winsome, or keeping yourself in the position where you can have ongoing influence as much as possible. And I've heard a couple of guys speaking against it, but just in a way that, I mean, it's like, you know, you can shear a sheep over and over and over again. You scalp it one time, and they had their chance, and that's it. There's no more influence after that. There's no opportunity. It just totally, I mean, they got their point across, and they were sincere, and they didn't like it, but it kind of just flared up, bombed out, and that's it. As opposed to, I didn't say anything publicly on Facebook, really, or anything else directly, but at the zoning committee, and this just happened to me, it's not toot my own horn or anything, but just, and I haven't said anything in the past or since then, but a lady came up to me who got up and spoke for it, her husband's involved in it. They'd come to her coffee shop, and she come and grabbed my arm as I was walking out the door, and just, we love you guys, please don't, we're still going to come to the coffee shop, we love you, you know, whatever. And they, reaching out to, because I just stood in the back, I didn't say anything, didn't say boo, but she knew where we probably stood, but yet wanted to maintain, you know, that relationship, even though, you know, coffee shop, whatever, you know, maybe somewhat superficial, but we would, if we wanted to, we could have a conversation with them about it, and I think they would be open to it. But when you go in there and just pound, you better make it count, because that's going to be the only time you're going to get to do it. So I think there is something to
strategy,
the vehicle of being winsome. Again, not the goal, but that.
This is all helpful to me. Thank you. Yeah, just I'm even thinking of Father-in-Law Richard's quote about people don't care what you know until they know you care. And like Matt said, if you're building a relationship, you're showing people you love them, you care about them, then when opportunities arise, you can probably winsomely or even maybe more directly at times. So the loving is the winsome, then maybe more directly speak into their lives.
And I mean, isn't this mere Christianity? When you compare the raw, bare bones expressions of the prophets to the message of Jesus, at the heart and soul of the message of Jesus was God is God, but he cares. He cares about you. And you can't read the Gospels with an open mind without getting that picture as well. But he's not any less holy.
For people who, their most comfortable way to take care of things is to just aggressively deal with it. You have to stop and go, okay, am I just doing what's comfortable? Is this best? Is this like God wants me to do it? And for then those of us who are maybe a little more what's more comfortable is to keep it real light and non-contradictory and comfortable. You have to stop and say, wait a minute, am I just doing what's comfortable, or am I following what God wants? And so that may lead us in different, you know, where you maybe, somebody might have to think a little more like, am I being winsome and somebody else has to think a little more like, am I being a wimp? You know, so it's that staying before God. I think it's easy to think of being the contradictory to God as being strongly willful. I will have my own will. And that may be at the heart of it. But I think so many times comfort is what gets us because it's under the radar. It's like, well, there's nothing wrong with this. And so I think it's easier, especially if you've been raised in the church, to have your radars up for willful, like direct willfulness. But if the radar is not really honed in so much on, it's just comfortable. You know, again, at that meeting, the people for it said, hey, we sent out letters to all the surrounding businesses, and not one of them are here to speak out against it, so they don't mind.
So, you know, here's what we're seeing. If we were ever ignorant of it, let's not be. In the minds of the power brokers of this world, the real issue is messaging. You have to say things right, and you can make anything happen. It's not a pursuit of truth. It's not understanding what's going on. It's having the right message. Because most people, if they're confronted with a, quote, argument that they can't easily knock down, they quit. They give up. Well, I don't know what to say to that. Right? And you know, I really recognize this, and I'm sure you all do if you listen to the news at all. Recently, in light of the just absolute failure of government that we have now, they're concerned about messaging. We need to get our messaging right, and we can fix inflation. Oh, really? Really? You know, we can fix the border. We can fix everything. Get your messaging right. And they really believe this. That's what the advisors behind the scenes are telling these failures. Get your messaging right. Well, I mean, I hope I'm not that stupid. Maybe some people are, but I want to be sure I'm not. It's not about messaging. It's about truth. And certainly this picture of a holy God, holiness is not about messaging. It's about independence from all the flux and the change in the world around. All the paths and avenues that the flesh goes down and the influences that it has on society, the trends and what's popular and all those things. A holy God says, that doesn't mean anything. That has nothing to do with me. And so there is the tendency among human beings to say to those that are trying to point them to a holy God, smooth things out here, okay? Speak smooth things to us. Turn aside out of the path. Don't hold this holy God before us.
Messaging, prophesying, deceits.
Therefore, thus saith the Holy One of Israel, because you despise this word and trust in oppression and perverseness, and stand thereon. Therefore this iniquity shall be to you as a breach ready to fall, swelling out in a high wall, whose breaking cometh suddenly at an instant. Okay. So, perhaps we've not had a personal experience like this, but in the ancient world where many things were made of masonry and were tall and heavy, we don't think that often, I suppose, unless we are trained in those areas, of the importance of foundation on something like a brick wall. I mean, brick is strong, right? It's hard. Just run into it if you have any doubt. But these massive stone walls, if they don't have support, they self-destruct. Gravity just causes them to crumble. I don't mean crumble. I mean crash down. Isn't it? Crumble kind of sounds gradual. It's usually a catastrophic failure when it happens. And in this world where you had this, the fortified cities and the sieges and everything, this was something that people had seen. You know, this seemingly stout, sturdy wall begins to swell at the bottom because it is not going to stand, and then suddenly it all comes crashing down. He gives another example. He shall break it as the breaking of the potter's vessel that is broken in pieces. He shall not spare, so that there shall not be found in the bursting of it a sherd to take fire from the hearth or to take water withal out of the pit. Okay, again, probably not something that you have direct experience with, but in this world Isaiah lives in, pottery was a everyday reality. They use it for all sorts of things. And not only the pottery itself, but if it breaks, it still has a lot of usefulness. Makes great ballots. We have evidence from antiquity of, in particular in Greece, of voting having been done on pottery sherds, they call them, pieces of broken pottery. And that's fortunate for us because they don't rot. Once you fire that clay, it's not quite eternal, but it lasts a very long time. So we find all that stuff. But you would use broken pottery for all sorts of things. He gives a couple of instances here. You take coals out of the fire. Pottery doesn't burn. You can use it as a little scoop of broken piece to move it from one hearth to another. I heard the bell. And you could also use it as a dipper, a piece of broken pottery. So he says this breaking is going to be so complete that you won't find a piece left over that's big enough to do these things with. So that's a pretty serious smash right there. Nothing left to even do anything with. Okay. Thank you for your attention. We'll stop right there. Thank you.
harvest fire and have the gift to all inspire and have not love. My words are vain as sounding brass and hopeless gain.
Spirit, come.